Welcome to NHL Hour with Bill Clement, an in-depth look inside the National Hockey League. NHL Home Ice, XM204.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the NHL Hour. This is Gary Bettman. Bill Clement is on special assignment doing something else, so Bill Daly, in the spirit of keeping the Bills together with me on Thursday afternoon, is
here
with
Bill.
Me. Have another Bill, the Deputy Commissioner. We're coming to you live on XM Home Ice, XM204, and NHL.com. Later in the show, we'll be joined by NHL coaching legend Scotty Bowman. And before then, we'll take calls, answer some emails. The call-in number, 1-877-645-6696. That's 1-877-645-6696. And the email address is nhlhour@nhl.com. Bill, what's new?
Oh, nothing much since you left the office. Actually, Gary just ran into the studio. He was off site for something, and it looked like we were going to open without him, but he made it on time.
Actually, for those of you who don't know New York geography, I was on Long Island about 40 miles from the studio 55 minutes ago. Actually, not to put a somber note on this, one of my close friends from college, his father, was stricken by a stroke and died, and I went to the funeral because this is somebody I've known, not just my friend, but his father since 1970. And he was a really good person. His name was Bill Dorman, and I know all of the Dormans and all of the friends and family of the Dormans will miss him.
I have spent my afternoon putting together a fairly detailed and long list of items I need to cover with you this afternoon. So,
are we going to do that on the radio?
We'll do it after the radio show, probably.
Okay. Well, you know, we would be remiss if we did not wish Bobby Orr a happy 60th birthday. The most amazing thing to me about that is I always looked it up to him as somebody much older and as a sort of role model in sports as I was growing up, and it dawns on me he's only a little more than 4 years older than I am. So he was clearly doing great things when I was just in school studying away. You know what? I think one of the things that I'd like to get on the table, and you can feel free to jump in on, is, and I'm sure a lot of the callers will want to discuss it, has to do with the supplemental discipline administered to Chris Pronger this week. And I think a fair amount of it has been glossed over and overly simplified when it has been compared to what supplemental discipline was imposed on Chris Simon. You know, people tend to say, well, they both kicked or stomped, and therefore the punishment should have been the same. And I really don't think that that's a fair representation of the analysis that Coley Campbell and the Hockey Operations Department did on this. There was an element that both plays had in common, namely the downward motion of the skate on a player's leg. But beyond that, I think the two circumstances are completely different, which is why the discipline that was imposed was different. Just, you know, to tick off the elements that were different, one was Simon was involved in something, a line change. It wasn't a hockey play. Chris Pronger's legs were wrapped up by Ryan Kessler's legs, and he was trying to get free. It doesn't excuse what Chris did, and which is why he got suspended. But also, you and I'm not meaning to pick on Chris Simon, but the fact is he had just, Chris did, come off a 25-game suspension 26 games ago, and there was a real concern about how he was conducting himself on the ice. And I think if you look at the totality of the circumstances, they are not at all equatable other than, you know, the initial act.
I think it underscores what a tough job Coley does and has to do every night. And, you know, we've said it before, each incident that he has to look at is like a snowflake, because each incident is different than every other incident, and the different factors involved. And I know, you know, he gave significant consideration to all the different factors that you just pointed out.
Well, and also, you know, people tend to overlook the fact that, you know, even if you want to contend that Pronger should have gotten more, the fact is 8 games is a serious suspension by any standard, perhaps people, you know, have gotten used to the fact that, that we have been imposing very severe discipline to make sure that we're getting or not getting, in effect, the type of conduct on the ice that we don't think is appropriate. It did cost Chris Pronger $600,000 plus. And no matter how much money you make or how much you have in the bank, that is a lot of money. So this was a severe penalty, and there are those who will argue it should have been more. There are even some who will argue it was too much. But in the totality of the circumstance, if you really analyze it and compare other things that have been punished, this was a fair and appropriate response. I also think that there's been, you know, some conspiratorialist theorist out there suggesting that, you know, somehow getting the video late was a problem. The fact is, my understanding is, since Hockey Operations is watching every game in progress, as that incident occurred, nobody saw it or thought anything of it, and it was only when we came into possession of the video after the fact that they were in a position to act, not because they weren't acting because what they saw was fuzzy. It was nobody knew it was a big deal until they saw the video that they ultimately used in the supplemental discipline hearing. And, you know, time will tell how much this cost Anaheim, because the races for playoff position are incredibly close.
And Chris Pronger's paying a pretty significant penalty. I think he forfeits close to $600,000 of his salary, and that's a pretty large sum of money.
Well, and also I think he's on notice that, you know, if he finds himself before Coley again, it won't be pretty. And hopefully, while the aim of supplemental discipline is to punish, it's also to make clear, to send a message to the person who committed the incident and to everybody else, is that certain types of conduct will not be tolerated.
Actually, we had another issue that came up as a result of a game last night and an injury that was suffered in San Jose, a fairly significant injury. But it goes back to, I've gotten several inquiries from the media today with respect to no-touch icing rule.
Don Cherry's favorite cause.
And whether the league and the general managers in particular will consider that again in light of last night's incident. And, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. Of course, they're free to do that. But I will say that that issue has been on the general manager's agenda each of the last 5 years, I believe. And as recently as February in Naples, the managers were of the view that they didn't want to make a change, that the race to the puck is an exciting play in hockey, and that while sometimes there are injuries and unfortunate injuries, it's an unfortunate part of the game and an exciting part of the game they don't want to eliminate. And in fact, the rule received less support this year, as I understand it, than it had ever before. And I think there was even a motion among the general managers that that they not consider it again for a 3-year period, a minimum of 3-year period, because of the diminishing support for moving to no-touch icing.
Well, actually, you're right. And if I'm not mistaken, and you can correct me in front of all these people if I am, the competition committee, the players, also weighed in on this subject. And the players have said they don't want to see a change in the rule, which really goes to my point on a lot of issues. We can't, In the context in which we live, sports league, 700 players playing, 30 teams, you can't overreact on an incident. You've got to look at a trend. If you see a lot of injuries, if you see a lot of plays that cause you concern, then you look to react. Obviously, you keep this in mind. You're aware of the fact that icing can be a dangerous play. But while the injuries that occur tend to be pretty bad, the frequency with which they occur is not particularly great. And it is, as you said, an exciting play. And most of the constituent groups, if not all of them, that we deal with on this subject, other than Mr. Cherry, who I have the utmost regard for and respect for, don't want to see a change. And so it's not apparently the mandate. And a shameless plug for two things that are near and dear to my heart. On the NHL Network, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, Cornell University is playing Harvard University, one of the great collegiate hockey rivals. In hockey, it's the ECAC tournament, and it will be on the NHL Network, so I've managed to plug two things that I like a lot. With that note, I will remind everybody that the call-in number is 1-877-NHL on XM, or 877-645-6696. That's 877-645-6696. And our email address is nhlhour@nhl.com. Why don't we go to the calls? And let's see, who do we have? Alan from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You're on XM204 with Gary and the other Bill, Bill Daly, our deputy commissioner.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, with the salary cap continuing to raise, how do you expect small market teams like Nashville and Florida to be able to continue to compete with high market teams like Detroit, Montreal, and Philly?
It's funny. I made a note of things that I wanted to discuss with Bill, and you actually asked one of the questions. Would you please explain to everyone, Bill, why the cap going up is a good thing in the context of the system we have?
Well, I think there's and then I can also answer the question. But the obviously, the fact that the cap is going up suggests that league-wide revenues are going up. And that's been the case. We've been very fortunate since coming back from the lockout that our revenues continue to increase and that attendance is at an all-time high, and we're going to set another attendance record this year. So the cap is entirely a function of where our revenues are league-wide, and the fact that the cap's going up means our revenues are going up. In terms of the ability to remain competitive, we built this system as a payroll range with a $16 million payroll range. Under our old system, we had a lot more disparity among payrolls. I believe 2 years before the lockout, we had a disparity of almost $70 million between the top payroll team and the low payroll team. And we found that in that type of system, it was difficult to maintain competitive balance. We made a judgment in collective bargaining that a range in the neighborhood of $16 million was a manageable range, that people, all clubs could be competitive with good management within that range. And I think our experience 3 years in has demonstrated that. And as we go into, as we continue to progress through the collective bargaining agreement, get farther out, we're starting to see some spread among clubs in their payroll, and yet it hasn't affected competitive balance. The other answer I would give is that part and parcel of this collective bargaining agreement was a decision by the owners to share more revenue with the higher revenue clubs, sharing with the lower revenue clubs, and that has the effect and is designed to have the effect of allowing those clubs to spend within the range to be competitive on a going forward basis. So, at least 3 years in, we're still happy with the way the system's working.
Yeah, I think the only two things that I'd add, and actually I think you touched on both of them, is one, there's a $16 million range, and you have to spend somewhere in that range. We believe that anywhere you spend in that range should enable you to be competitive, and so you don't have to spend the cap. You can spend to the lower end and still have an opportunity to be competitive. And if you look at the standings and you look at what you think teams are spending on payroll, you'll see that there isn't a correlation in that spread. And as Bill said, the owners stepped up big time to make the system work with revenue sharing. And without that, I don't think this system works at all. Tim in North Carolina, you're on XM204 with Bill and Gary. What can we do for you?
Hey, guys. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Question for you. I'm not a big fan of this shootout. Has there been any discussion on going to a 3-on-3, possibly after the 4-on-4, maybe 3 minutes of 4-on-4, 2 minutes of 3-on-3, something like that?
The answer to your question is there's been only the most tiny discussion because, fortunately, and please don't take this the wrong way, most people don't feel about the shootout the way you do. The feedback we've gotten on every metrics that we use to measure these things is that overwhelmingly, not unanimously, but overwhelmingly, people love the shootout. And in fact, the sense I get when I'm in buildings a lot is people want to see us get through sudden death overtime, the 5 minute 4-on-4, so that we can get to the shootout. Bill, you were at a game last night where there was a shootout. I was watching it on TV. The building looked electrified.
It was, and everybody was on their feet, and we've seen that throughout the league. And I would say perhaps the largest contingent of critics, or at least skeptics, with respect to the shootout when we did it 3 years ago, was our general managers, and I think even our general managers, a large majority of them now accept it as an established part of the game and an exciting part of the game.
Absolutely, Kelsey in Alberta, you're on XM 204 with Bill and Gary.
Hi guys, how are you?
We're good. How are you?
Good. I have a question, and it's about a penalty call, and this rule really kind of bugs me. I'm wondering, how can you have a penalty be called against someone, but at the same time have that person be called for diving?
Actually, the simple answer is there can be a penalty, but if you try to embellish it to make sure that the referees see it, if you get tripped and you're going down, but you make it into one of the all-time great swine dives, the fact that you've tried to embellish it is the reason that you can get an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, and we're perfectly comfortable with that. You don't see it a whole heck of a lot, but it is out there, and for good reason, because we don't want guys embellishing calls, because for every embellishment you'll get on a call where there should be a penalty, you'll get guys trying to get a call when one isn't deserved. And the refs have a hard enough job without acting going out on the ice. Jackson in Washington, D.C., you're with Bill and Gary on XM 204. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
We're doing good.
I have an idea to share with you, and it's born out of this student rush program the Washington Capitals do this year. It's a program where a college or high school student can go in the morning, they wait in line, and they show a student ID while buying a ticket, and they get a huge discount, a great seat. I did it the other night when the Capitals played the Thrashers, and I was sitting about 10 feet from the ice. I had a $25 ticket. It was great. And also, I was wondering if the league is doing anything similar to this, but if not, my idea is that the league has a sponsored program where every team would have a certain amount of games written into the schedule where a student would come and show an ID and get a discount. Because when you think about it, there are a lot of NHL cities that have major colleges right in there as well, and I think it would be a huge moneymaker.
It's an interesting idea. It's actually a very good idea, and I think the Capitals are being very cutting-edge and aggressive in doing it. Actually, I think Pittsburgh does it as well. The issue is most of our buildings don't have a lot of seats that aren't being sold. There are some teams that could fill their buildings better, but on a league-wide basis, we're playing to better than 92% of capacity, and I think in those markets where they have the extra seats and they have colleges, they're doing things that they can to attract college students into the building.
It goes to the point you've made many times, Gary, which is the clubs are experts in their own market with respect to the circumstances, the amount of seats they have to sell, who they're trying to appeal to. They really are the closest to try to make those decisions.
Absolutely. Bill in New Jersey, you're on with Bill and Gary. What can we do for you?
Gary, man, it's a pleasure talking to you. Two quick things. The first thing, I just wanted to see if I can get some information about the NHL trip to Prague. For the beginning of next season of Rangers, if there's any packages or how to find some information out about that.
Bill's a travel agent in his spare time. Would you please tell this gentleman how he can go to Prague?
Well, as you probably know, the details of the game, or the games, that we're playing two games in the Cheska Arena in Prague on October 4th and October 5th. Those are a Saturday and a Sunday. I would anticipate that both clubs will have an allocation of tickets to make available to their fans and sponsors. And certainly you can always email me if you're interested, and I can hook you up with the right people to buy tickets if that's what you want to do.
Yes, definitely. I'd like to get an email address.
Sure. It's bdaily@nhl.com. It's a pretty simple formula.
But don't be complaining on officiating calls using that email address.
Daily is D-A-L-Y.
Great.
You said you had a second question.
The other part of it was, I don't want you to hate me for this. I know you're going to hear this every week. It was just some kind of parody in the officiating. I see him making calls where the stick just touches the person or making a call, but then there's a free-for-all in front of the net. People get pushed into the goalie by a defenseman, and they're calling it on the offensive player. I mean, I'd like to see some more parity in the officiating. It's killing me.
The officials are more consistent than they get credit for. There's always the passionate view of a fan wanting nothing but the best in every call for his club. But when you say they put a stick on him, the notion of the standard that we're using for the officials is if you put a stick on somebody and you don't have body position and you cost them a half a step, you may have broken up a play. And the only way that we've been able to open up the ice and emphasize speed and skill and scoring chances is to call the standard very strictly. There's no reason for the stick to be up. Don't put it horizontal to the ice. Keep it down, and you won't get called for those types of penalties. Do we have time for another call before the break? Then we should do that. How about Joe in Minnesota? You're on XM 204 with Bill and Gary.
Hi, you guys. You do a great job. Hockey is as best as it can be right now.
Thank you.
And thanks for saving the game. But I just want to bring up a few points. Why is it when, like last night, I'm a Wild fan, but I don't like see anybody get hit in the back, because we just had a gopher get hit in the back a few nights ago too. And why is it that when somebody gets hit in the back, why is that player not immediately escorted off the ice and he's out for the game? And that, because he only got a 2-minute penalty. Since we have a bunch of stars in the game right now, it'd be nice to see him on TV more. I know they're on commercials once in a while, but I mean, we got some of the best stars in hockey right now, and this would be the best time to show our game off. And I just want to say thanks, and you guys do a great job. I'll listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you for calling in. We've probably never had more great stars, particularly young stars in the game, than we do now, and we are doing more to market and promote them than we've ever done before. We're getting unprecedented cooperation from the players and the Players Association, and you're going to see more and more. With respect to hitting from behind, we don't like it. It gets penalized. It's generally a major penalty, but you also have to look at the circumstances. When a player is playing the puck and he turns his back on somebody who's about to check him at the last second, that isn't your classic hit from behind, and every circumstance is different. But the officials are instructed that that is an area of concern for us. We do not like and we do not tolerate hitting from behind. Stay tuned. We will be back to our callers. Hang in there if you're on the board. Coming up is Scotty Bowman. When we come back, we'll take your calls. We'll answer your emails. You're on the NHL Hour on NHL Home Ice. That's XM204 and NHL.com. This is NHL Hour on XM 204. Welcome back. This is Gary Bettman along with Bill Daly. We're broadcasting live from the NHL store powered by Reebok, XM 204, NHL.com. The call-in number again is 1-877-645-6696, and the email address is NHLHour@NHL.com. I was a little distracted listening to Bare Naked Ladies as we came back. I'm also distracted about thinking about the next person who's going to be on the air with us, namely Scotty Bowman. Scotty, how are you?
Oh, hi. Hi, Gary. Hi, Bill.
You know, I was thinking about you before we took the air, and I was marveling at the fact, you know, we can talk about the fact that you coached 5 decades. You started in the 60s. You coached after the turn of the century. You were in St. Louis, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Detroit. You won 9 Stanley Cups, 28 playoff appearances, 16 first-place teams, 13 Stanley Cup finals, and as I said, 9 Cups. You could have the best record of any coach in any sport. Do you think you've gotten the recognition you deserve?
Oh, sure, Gary. You make a good agent if I want to make a comeback, but...
We could break some news here tonight.
No, you're right. I started at a young age. I was very fortunate, you know, to get a chance through the late Lynn Patrick from the great Patrick family. I had coached his son Craig, who later was a great manager in Pittsburgh, and on my team in Montreal. That was when U.S. players very seldom came from the U.S. to play up in Canada, and Lynn sent his son Craig, I think it was about 15 or 16, Larry Plo, who also was from Boston area. He came up and played on the same team, and I was coaching the juniors, and I got to know Lynn Patrick, and then when the league, I was one of the fortunate ones when the league expanded, as everyone knows, and the late Clarence Campbell in his vision decided to go from 6 to 12 and put the six expansion teams in the West Division. So I got my break that way, and when I think now, Gary, with the people in the league, the way that the coaches have come so far, and I was fortunate when I first started, if I could even know the lines of the other teams, and we had a great broadcaster, Dan Kelly, in St. Louis, and I used to use all my influence to try to see if he could find out what the other lines would be from the other team, but he never would tell me. But yeah, it's come a long way, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And you know, I know now the coaching is so sophisticated than when we first started.
What is the biggest difference besides video in coaching? And maybe video defines it all, because when you started coaching, you didn't have the access to what was actually taking place on the ice after the fact like you do now.
I would say, Gary, the most important thing now is your staff, how everybody pitches in. And I know that the teams that are successful, if they can keep their people together, it's certainly a big advantage. But you know, I look at the different types of coaches in the league, and you know, there are some that are very active behind the bench, or some that are quiet, but they all fill in with the parts that they need. And I think the biggest difference would be the staff, the people that goaltender coaches, power play and penalty kill coaches, and you know, it's just like you said, there's so much information now. When I first started, we never had any of that information. So while it was equal for everybody, so much information now that no one or two people could process it.
When you started coaching in St. Louis, how big was your staff?
I was it.
and your last year in Detroit, how big was your staff?
Well, I had two very good associates in Dave Lewis and Barry Smith, so, and a goalie coach as well. So yeah, that, and I would say now the teams have, you know, they've even added other people. The video coach is probably what every team has now as well. He just sits there, and it's so, when I marvel at the teams now, because sometimes I go and travel a little bit at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year with the Red Wings, and I see, boy, the game's over and the coaches are on, and all the teams are doing it. They're on the airplanes going to the next game, and they're so busy just watching what happens. So you're right. It's something that had to happen, and it's made, I guess at times the coaches get critiqued enough that there's too much coaching, but I would say now the innovative coaches, they still have an edge.
When you talk about innovative coaches, do you think, in light of the rule changes that were made 2.5 years ago, that the coaches are putting a little bit too much defense back in the game? And why is there a tendency to coach more defense than offense?
Some do, but you know, Gary, when I watch so many games and I see teams, and I guess the newest trend we have in hockey is for people to really clog up the scoring area in front of the net. And I remember talking to your referee in chief, Steve Wacom, last year, and we were often talking about, you know, do we need all these fouls, or do we need to have the scrutiny and with the two officials? And like he mentioned, you know, that scoring area, because there was always a question in the last year or so, I mean, how should defensemen be allowed more leeway? And he said, you know, the way the teams drop down and they all sort of, I say they all try to play goalkeeper, it is a good tactic in some ways, but at the same time, they're a long way from the opposition net. And I think the teams that can adjust a little bit, do things differently, they seem to have an edge, because yes, fine, you're going to stop the other team from getting certain shots, but you've pretty well taken your attack away. So I think the reason you mentioned about you know, to win something, you're always going to be protecting a lead at some time in the game or the series, and I guess it's just come around that people, it seems to be easier to work on your defense. That's what teams practice defense, and you know, especially your skill. There's some players that have so much more skill. They don't have any trouble playing defense when they put their mind to it.
I know, are a great fan of the game. You must be watching these incredible races. What's the biggest difference between coaching the regular season and coaching in the playoffs?
Well, your team matchups, Gary, are you know, sometimes you'll hit the wrong team at the wrong time. You can have a powerhouse, or you can be a team that's at the other end, and just it's a good matchup. And obviously, going down the stretch, the health of your team is so crucial. And I think when you look back, there, it's pretty hard for a team to play up to 28 games if they went the limit. It's usually somewhere around 22, 24 games, and not get people out of the lineup. So I guess the teams that have had some adversity during the season have had to bring up some players and had to pad, at times their lineups don't look too strong. But, you know, they've got the depth. And you have to be very fortunate. I know a couple of the years in Detroit, we once had one player miss in 22 games. One player had the flu one night. But that's so unusual. I've always felt that the health of especially your key players, I mean, there are some players you're going to be able to get players in to replace them, but there's some that they're not going to be able to be replaced. So I would say the health of your team and the opponent. Some teams just you know, you match up against some teams and you match up against others, it doesn't work.
We're speaking with legendary coach Scotty Bowman. Scotty, having coached over five decades, what's the biggest difference in coaching players in the 60s and in the 90s into the turn of the century?
I would think that the biggest difference which I've seen is the players now are so much there's so much equipment out there for them to get better. You know, it doesn't matter what you're talking about. You're talking about injuries, or you're talking about conditioning. It's all so much better. But you know, I think the tough part for a coach now is to ice time is something that I used to always try to work on, because some players now play a lot, and you know, everything's out in the open now. And I remember when the league first put out the statistics for ice time, during the end of my career, and a few times I'd grab all the sheets, because some of the players, that's the first thing they looked at is how much minutes. I can't do much if I'm playing 14 or 15 minutes. But I would say the biggest difference is that, and also to keep players on their. You can't do the things that I did when I first started. Players have more autonomy now, you know, with the new type of agreements that are in place for the business side. You know, you got to have a pretty straight line that you're going to be up front with the players, because at certain times in their careers they can move if they don't like what's going on.
I'm sure everybody liked playing for you. Let me put you on the spot. Best team you ever coached?
Well, statistically, the Canadian team in the 70s, Gary, it's hard to go. It was a team that we lost eight games during the season. We lost one or two in the playoffs. We led the league in goals, four in goals against, and you know that was some team. Another team that was real close to it, and just to show you that it can happen, was our team in Pittsburgh. I think we saw they had the record. They won the last 17 games of the season, but we ran into an Islander team that was a real big underdog, and we lost Mario for a couple of games, Mario Lemieux, and we didn't get out of the second round. But I'd go back to the Montreal team, and the last team I coached in Detroit in 02 under the old system, when we were able to get Brett Hull and Luke Robitaille at the end of their careers, and plus the center ice, what we had with Steve Yzerman and Sergei Fedorov and Igor Larionov. I mean, we'll probably have more than a half a dozen, but all Hall of Famers in time. But I think the Montreal team,
in the 70s, Gary had 11 players that are in the Hockey Hall of Fame. So that was a pretty good team to coach.
And your point about Pittsburgh and Lemieux getting hurt, it goes back to what you said before about one of the key things to the playoffs is staying healthy. You've coached in the goaltender position, Dryden, Hasek, Barrasso. You've had great leaders who played for you in Yzerman and Gainey. And you've coached superstars like Lemieux and LaFleur. Who stands out in your mind more than any other player that you coached?
You know, it's tough, Gary, because when I first started, you know, I always like to try to separate the players from before expansion post expansion in '67, because you know when I started my career in St. Louis, we had Glenn Hall. It'd be hard for people to figure out now. He won the Conn Smythe Trophy, and we lost the finals four straight. That's how good he was. And we had other great Hall of Famers at the end of their careers. But so I kind of separated. And, you know, Mario was a special type of player because he used his great reach to his advantage. He was just a wonderful talent. He couldn't practice very much. He had some sicknesses, as we know. He had some injuries. We had some great players in Montreal, and it's you know, like you mentioned, LaFleur and the great defense we had with Robinson and Savard and Lapointe, and then the players in Detroit, like Yzerman, this fellow Lidstrom is some player, and you know, there's a player, Gary, that doesn't get much recognition because we never got it done and I still live in Buffalo, but Gilbert Perreault. If he would be playing today under the way that the league plays, he's a wonderful player to have on a team. And a guy that I talked to today, Gary, and I was pretty excited because we've become pretty good friends, even though we were big rivals, talking about all-time players. I was fortunate to have him in one series in the Canada Cup, and that would be Bobby Orr.
Sure, it's his birthday.
And you know from your days and watching and everything, a guy that only played 10 years in the league, yet people put him in the same level of the great players that played the game. So that's something. And Bobby Orr turns 60 today, and
right.
He was just a wonderful player.
We had wished him a happy birthday before, but I'll spare everybody having to listen to me sing it. Let me ask you one more question before we let you go. You're a consultant with the Red Wings. What was all this stuff last summer about you and the Leafs?
Well, our senior vice president, Jimmy DeVellano, asked me if he called me and said they wanted to speak with me. And I was living in Buffalo, and I did go for a couple of interviews. It was kind of intriguing to talk to the people there. It was a monumental task to try to how are we going to get started. And the people were in place that there was a lot of decisions that they would have had to make, and they weren't prepared to make them at that time. And of course, now we've gone on, and Cliff Fletcher is kind of the interim, caretaker of the franchise right now until they can get somebody. But it was a little bit late in my career, Gary, and I've been so pleased with when I talked to Marion and Mike Ilitch 14 years ago. I said I would like to end up a Red Wing, and they said, as long as we are with this team, you know, no matter what you're doing. I only went for 2 years, and I stayed nine, and I've been 5 years with them as a consultant. So it just didn't work out, and I'm very, satisfied where I am.
I don't think anybody would accuse you of overstaying your welcome. Scotty, thank you for being with us today, and thanks for all you do for this game.
Well,
all the best.
Well, we've been good, and you've been awful helpful to the game, Gary, and I think the show is just something that the people would want to listen to, and I'm one of the people that listens to your show, and I enjoy it.
Scotty, take care of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Scotty. That was legendary coach Scotty Bowman. When we come back, we'll take your calls and answer your emails on the NHL Hour on XM204. If you're on hold, hang in there. We'll be with you shortly.
Rob Dibble from the show on MLB Home Plate, XM 175. Now back to NHL Hour with Gary Bettman.
Welcome back to the NHL Hour. This is Gary Bettman, along with Bill Daly. We're broadcasting live from the NHL Store, powered by Reebok in Manhattan. We're on NHL Home Ice, XM204, and NHL.com. The call-in number again is 1-877-645-6696. Let's go right to the callers. Ron in San Jose, you've been on for over a half hour, so thank you. What can we do for you?
Thanks, guys. I appreciate the show. First question, then suggestion, and I'll take your answers off the air. My question is why are players allowed to come into the league right at trade deadline after sitting out all season? Example, Peter Forsberg, this is like the second time that he's done it. And then, you know, the two boys in Anaheim. I don't think it's fair for other teams that are, you know, coming up with a strategy or game plan for the season, as well as the guys that have earned the spot that have been playing there, you know, all season long. And my suggestion is I really look forward to this hour because I really like to hear what the other fans, you know, have questions around the league. Maybe if we could, you know, listen to the guest speakers on other programs, it'd be great. I'll take your answers off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Bill, why don't you answer the question?
Actually, it's a very, very good question and obviously something that has been brought up a couple times from some of our fans in the media this year. In particular, because we had a couple free agents who joined the league late in the season. We actually have in place already a couple of rules that are intended to deal with this scenario. The most significant rule is that, you know, they did have a practical deadline to rejoin a team in the National Hockey League in order to be eligible for playoff play, and that was the trade deadline. All players have to be on a reserve list at the time of the trade deadline to be eligible to play in the playoffs. So, and as you know, probably we moved the trade deadline earlier in the season than it used to be under our old collective bargaining agreement. So there is a practical deadline in our rules already. We also have a rule that's existed for a long time that is intended to deal with this issue, and that's a bylaw that says if a player plays in Europe after the start of our season, in order to be signed before re-entering the league, he has to be waived. And that is a clear disincentive to clubs to negotiate with and sign these players. Obviously, neither Peter Forsberg nor Teemu Selanne played in Europe after the start of the season, so they weren't subject to that bylaw. Potentially, if we see more and more of these and the managers are concerned about the competitive issues involved in these types of signings, it is something we might address with the Players Association. We do have a rule for restricted free agents that is in the CBA that if you don't sign a contract by December 1st of a year, you're ineligible to play for the remainder of the year. That does not apply to unrestricted free agents, but perhaps it could in the future.
Well, and also I think the salary cap to some extent mitigates the impact that the acquisition of players at any point in the season could have. I mean, obviously, if you're improving your roster at the last minute, it doesn't look right, but since everybody's playing with the same number of chips, the impact isn't quite as great as it used to be. Carla in Burbank, you're with Bill and Gary on XM 204.
Thank you for taking my call, gentlemen.
Thank you for calling.
My question would be, in a time where traditional press is providing less and less ink for this league, and in an era where it's really growing via the Internet, will the NHL issue a directive to teams to give credentials to established bloggers such as myself, who is the most read person on the LA Kings but is not recognized by the team?
That's an excellent question, and as you know, not all bloggers are created equally. And we have to strike a balance among the blogging community as to who's a legitimate blogger with a legitimate following and who isn't. Some clubs do credential bloggers, and we'll probably be issuing a series of recommendations for our clubs to handle this issue for the start of next season. We do believe that there is a role for bloggers in the hockey family going forward, but as I said, not everybody should qualify as a blogger who could be or should be media credentialed. But that is an excellent question. Jake from South Carolina, you're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM 204.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I look forward to this show. Appreciate your honesty with all the answers.
Well, thank you for calling in, and thank you for being a fan.
Yeah, I actually good timing with having Scotty Bowman on earlier this year. I read an interview with Mike Ilitch, Ken Holland, Jim Delavano, and Scotty Bowman. And during the interview, the topic of the Red Wings moving to the Eastern Conference was brought up. And there was quoted in there saying that they had been told for the next 4 or so years that the likelihood of the Red Wings moving to the Eastern Conference was very good. As a fan, I look forward to that. It's hard to have an 8-to-5 job and wait the games to come on at 10 or 10:30 at night. So I'm really looking forward to that day where I can watch all the games and not only half of them. So I just want to see if there's any validity to that, and if so, I'm definitely for it. So I appreciate your answers.
Well, I didn't see the interview, and I didn't have that conversation with them. Bill, did you?
No, I didn't have that conversation.
Okay, the answer is, in the conversation that we have had, is that obviously if the Red Wings were to go east, there would be two sets of problems. One, there are a lot of clubs in the West who view the Red Wings as an important regular season rival and wouldn't want to lose the opportunity to see them as frequently as they do. And the second is, if somebody's going to go east, then somebody east has to go west, and we haven't had any volunteers. The point that has been made clear to us is, and I understand it because it's a legitimate position for the Red Wings to have, is that if, for whatever reason, a relocation or expansion or the like, a team goes east, the first team to go east should be the Red Wings, because the Red Wings, having been an Eastern time zone team in the West forever, virtually, it should come to them first. And obviously, if we do have to make any reallocations of alignment, then this is something that will be one of the primary issues that we're going to have to consider. John in New Jersey, you're on with Bill and Gary.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I was wondering if the league has any policy or gives any guidance as far as allowing fans to go down and watch warm-ups before the game. I'll give you a background on something that happened recently. My daughter, who wants to see her favorite team play in all the arenas by her 30th birthday, this past weekend was at her 21st arena and went down as normal to go down and watch warm-ups. And when we went to walk down, we were told unless we had tickets in the suites or the 100 levels, we weren't allowed down to watch warm-ups. That is the first arena out of the 21 we've been to that has ever been an issue.
This is generally done on a building-by-building, club-by-club basis. Who, might I ask, was the team so we can look into it?
The team was Colorado Avalanche.
Interesting, because that's historically a very fan-friendly building and a great place to watch the game. By the way, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you, without having met her, I think your daughter is wonderful.
Thank you. She'd be willing to meet you sometime, too. Well, I'll tell you, we're actually double fans. Season ticket holders there, it's a double. And she'd be willing to talk to you about that and about her experiences with some of the other arenas.
I'm sure we'll bump into each other at the Rock, and you should feel free to introduce yourself.
She's run into Bill Daly before at the old arena.
I hope I was nice.
Oh, you are. She actually recognized you when nobody else did.
That's pretty frequent, actually.
That shows that she's just a great fan, Bill.
Yeah, the building manager did come down and meet with us about the issue there in Denver. And we were told it was a typical overreaction. They have a few fans that would not go down to their – or would not leave that area when the game started or when the fans that actually had the tickets for those seats would come down.
Well,
I find it odd that the typical – you know, they take the response of, well, we'll punish the masses for the sins of the few instead of punishing those few by – you know, if you immediately eject them or something, if they're going to give you grace, I'm sure you'll do that a few times and the people will get the message quickly.
Well, you know, making sure that our arenas are safe and comfortable and secure and that people get to their seats appropriately is the most important thing that we have to provide, other than the playing of the game, obviously. But we'll make a call out to Colorado and see what's up. And if we wish you luck in the final 9 arenas you need to get to. How old is your daughter if she has to do this by her 30th birthday? Well, we'll look into it and get back to you. I guess our producer was a little too quick on the button. John in Detroit, you're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM204.
Bill, Gary, good. Thanks for letting me get a chance to talk to you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you for
calling. Thanks for calling, John.
I guess I'm going to kind of piggyback off of one call. I'm not sure if it was the one in San Jose about the, well, I think it was the Wings going to the East. My question is a little more broad. I know you guys changed the scheduling around and how what teams play who. I know we were talking about having more teams go to the East and play the West and things like that, but I hadn't really heard all the details. I'm wondering if you could kind of elaborate on that a little bit, as well as have during any of the GM meetings that were going on, has it been talked about maybe possibly restructuring the league a little bit to help the amount of travel for the teams in the West, because it seems like there's a lot larger difference of travel, the distance-wise, than it is in the East. Like, say, for someone like a team in Philadelphia. Philadelphia doesn't travel hardly at all, or Buffalo. All their games are right so close to each other.
Well, interestingly, your questions are very related. I mean, travel, and the travel efficiencies had a lot to do with the schedule developing the way it did, and building interdivisional rivalries, which is the scheduling matrix we came out of the lockout with. That's what we were hearing from our fans they wanted to see. Certainly our general managers felt that more familiarity inside the division was something that was fan-friendly, built to passionate rivalries among clubs. But as we've come out of the lockout now 3 years, I think there was a feeling of fans, particularly in the Western Conference, that they wanted to see more clubs from the Eastern Conference, and our board took a step in that direction at their winter meeting by approving a change to the matrix of the schedule, which will take effect next year, where we'll actually be increasing, almost doubling the amount of interconference games that we have currently. We currently have 10 games played interconference that will go up to 18 games played interconference next year. With each team playing every team in the other conference at least once, and three of those teams they'll play home and away. So you will see more, as a Detroit fan, you will see more of the Eastern Conference next year as we move forward.
Weston, Texas, you'll be our last caller because we've only got a couple of minutes left.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm a huge hockey fan.
Thank you.
And I'm a big fan of the Red Wings. Used to work at Olympia years ago. And my question, I have a couple, but Mr. Pronger only gets 8 games versus Mr. Simon gets 30 games.
Were you with us at the top of the hour when we
discussed? I was not. I caught it in the middle.
You know what? I don't have enough time to answer it again. Please listen to this. The replay's on NHL.com. You can download it, but we gave a pretty extensive reason as to why we thought it was reasonable. We've got to go. I thank everybody for calling in. This has been the NHL Hour. Coming up next on NHL Home Ice is In the Slot with Phil Esposito and Jim Taddy. Bill Daly, thank you for filling in for Bill Clement. We'll be back on Thursday, March 27th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Bill Clement will be back then to answer more of your calls and emails. Goodbye, and have a great day of hockey.
Thanks, everyone.
They play 82 games to figure out which 16 teams have to win 16 more games before they lose 4 out of 7, and, well, you do the math yourself. It all adds up to the push to the playoffs. NHL Home Ice, XM204.